Matthew 23, verses 25 and 26 is where we've left off. This is, of course, where Jesus is continuing his denunciation of the scribes and Pharisees. He's had a lot to say about them that is obviously not very favorable, and we're now getting to the point where he's coming to kind of wrap things up a little bit. Once again, Matthew chapter 23, reading verses 25 and 26. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye cleanse the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full from extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first the inside of the cup and of the platter, that the outside thereof may become clean also." If you look back a little bit in this chapter, verses 13 through 15, also verse 23, you will see that in the preceding verses, Jesus used the word hypocrite. Anybody remember what a hypocrite described in the first century? We've got the same thing today. You ever watch a TV show and the actor or the actress just kind of strikes your curiosity? Anybody ever go back and do maybe a quick internet search on an actor or actress? Or maybe I'm just weird. Sometimes I see some people and I'm kind of curious. All right, we've got two or three people that are willing to join me. Sometimes I... Yeah. Sometimes you see these characters and you wonder what they're like in real life. If you go back and you look at what's Wikipedia, or you look at the entry that tells a little bit about them, you see that what's on the screen is not nearly what they're like in real life. You may have someone that appears to be so caring and so considerate and so loving, and you know they're on their 10th marriage. Then you have some psycho killer, and you look him up or you look her up, and one of them, I mean, they're down there at the soup kitchen helping people out. So when we think about people who are actors and actresses, they're not always what they appear on the screen. That's really the idea behind the word hypocrite. It was someone who pretended. They would act in one way, but that was not the way that they really were. So we have that same kind of thing when we look at our culture in Jesus. As I mentioned, Matthew 23, verses 13 through 15, also verse 23, he introduces this word and keeps coming back to it. In addition to failing to be trustworthy with their oaths, we talked about this last week in verses 16 through 22. Then in verses 23 and 24, he said that they neglected the weightier matters of the law. They should have been paying attention to things like faith, justice, mercy, but they were out there in their herb garden making sure that they gave a tenth of the smallest herbs. Jesus now points out in Matthew 23 that they were inwardly corrupt. He illustrates the moral depravity of these fellows by peeling dishes. The word translated cleanse is an interesting word. It's applied to a lot of things. It's used to describe the cleansing, the freeing the people of leprosy, Matthew chapter 10, verse 8. Over in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 26, Paul, as he's talking about the church, remember he says he's cleansed it. He's purified it. People are free from their sins. It's the word that's also used by James in James chapter 4, verse 8. Remember what James said concerning the hands of people? Not literally, but James says, "You sinners, do what with your hands? Cleanse them. Purify them. Make them right." It's also the word that's used in 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. If we walk in the light as he is in the light, what's the blood of Christ do? It cleanses us. It purges us of all sins. Here, it's expressed with the present tense. When you think about these fellows, we know about their ritualistic washings. They wanted to make sure that the things that they used didn't have any kind of ceremonial defilement. So when Jesus says, "Ye wash the dishes," present tense, what was he saying about these fellows and their defilement? They wanted to avoid it. They would take great steps to make sure that their dishes were clean. The word cup describes what we would normally associate with the word drinking vessel. You see this other word platter, though. Now, when we think of a platter, what comes to mind? Large. All right, we think about Thanksgiving, Christmas. We have this large platter, big ham or big turkey on there. But here, this word that's translated platter has a different sense. It would describe a shallow side dish, maybe to hold condiment sauce, maybe some kind of special meat, or some other kind of special food. So these fellas, when it came to these dishes, the cups, these special platters, they were clean in every way. But, not literally, but the image is, if you looked on the inside of the dish or the cup, though, what would it look like? Yeah, like they never washed it from last Thanksgiving. Oh, it looks good on the outside, but it's still got the turkey or it's still got the ham. So you bring that out of the cupboard, you want to serve or eat off that? No, that's gross. That's sick. Everybody would be able to identify with that. And people would say, "Well, look how nice the outside is." Well, there's more to the cup, there's more to the platter than the outside. Jesus takes that analogy and applies it to people. We see that today, do we not?
externally, someone, and it happens all the time in the work environment, someone is as nice to you as they can be. But what are they doing behind your back? They're going to stab you in the back. And you find the same kind of thing in religion. There are some people who, when it comes to an outward show, their external appearance, they appear to be very, very religious. But inside, what are they really like? All right, like dead men's bones. Evil, corrupt, foul, immoral, ungodly. A lot of different words that you could put in here to describe these people. A lot of this goes back to the Sermon on the Mount. One of the passages that would come to my mind from Matthew chapter 5 would be verse 8. Blessed are the who in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the pure in heart. But in this particular case, these people were far from pure. The end of verse 25 is where Jesus said he knew that these men were full from extortion and excess. Here again is a place where the verb tense is significant. When he says full, it's a verb. And it is a present tense verb. So as Jesus looked at the insides of these people, he said on a regular basis, we see corruption. Everybody has their bad days or their off days. But Jesus said, this is a constant, this is a perpetual state for you people. Extortion, what do we think of when we look at that particular word? Somebody's guilty or charged with extortion.
Money.
All right, money is going to be involved. And not only is money involved, I mean, money could be procured legitimately or rightly, but when money is procured by extortion, what's involved? All right, it's really a form of stealing. Someone, maybe embezzlement, there is some kind of unlawful activity. So when you think about these fellas, they look good externally. Inwardly, though, Jesus said they're full. They're just filled up with this greedy desire for gain, and you know they're willing to use unlawful means to get it. You can relate that, can you not, back to the verse 14? Remember, Jesus said these fellas were shafting some folks. Who'd they take advantage of? The widows. You know, bad enough to shaft somebody who's rich. But what about the poor widow woman? All she has is her house. All she has is that piece of property. And these fellows are going out after that. So it really should be beyond unthinkable, but this is precisely what these fellows were doing. Then you have a second sin, which is described by two different words depending on the manuscripts. Some manuscripts would use a word that means a lack of self-control. Other words would have a word which means wrongdoing or wickedness. Then we come down to verse 26. Jesus again uses the word cleanse, and it's kind of an interesting play on words. Verse 25, he says, you're cleansing this stuff. But then in verse 26, he said, let me talk to you about real cleansing. Let me talk to you about the true cleansing, what really should be cleansed. He said, first or second? First. Initially, what do you wash? The inside. Well, we may not always do dishes in that way, but that's probably not a bad way. We start on the inside, and then after that's all been cleaned out, we get rid of the muck and the grime and the dirt, then we start on the outside. But for the spiritual life, where do we need to begin? The inside or the outside?
Inside.
The inside. A lot of times, though, people kind of get things mixed up. Do we not find cases where people want the outside to look good and then... Yeah. I'm thinking of someone I talked to within the last couple weeks, person who needs to come back and write things with God, and the person said, well, you know, I need to get these external things fixed up. No, you don't. You need to fix the internal things. You have the desire to go ahead and write things with God. And if you have that and act on that, what's going to happen to the external? It's just going to kind of bleed through and it's going to show. But so many times people get things out of whack. Is it wrong to have a good external appearance?
No.
No. I mean, we should have it. If the inside is right, then the outside should follow. So nothing wrong with that. And Jesus is not saying it's wrong to, if you will, have a religious exterior. One other quick point, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. Do you see, as Jesus talks about these Pharisees, a difference between verse 25 and 26? Warn to you, scribes and Pharisees. All right, that would be one difference. Very good. Anything else?
Blind.
All right, that would be another difference. Look at the word Pharisee. Yeah, verse 25 is plural. Pharisees. 26, it's singular. You think Jesus knew the difference between singular and plural?
Yes.
I think he probably did. Why change?
Yeah, but you could be talking to the group and say Pharisee.
Yeah, you could. But here I think it's a way of, as he continues to address the group, as you mentioned, it's a way to personalize it. And it's a way to say, hey, this is really serious stuff. If you didn't get it from the illustration, then I want you to know, I'm talking to the group, but I'm now kind of individually as well, making this particular point. So listen up. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verses 27 and 28?
No. I realize that Christ taught in parables a lot of the time, but he's not really... Why would he teach them this way instead of saying, you keep your outward appearance clean, but your inward heart is full of extortion and unrighteousness? Why wouldn't he just plainly say that to them versus saying it in this way?
One of my teachers used to say Jesus was kind every chance people gave him. It seems to me that the Lord, even though these people are about as far out as anybody can possibly be, he's still trying to present things in such a way where he's trying to, you know, maximize the effect, but at the same time offer the least amount of antagonism.
Wouldn't they still understand what he was saying by doing?
You would think so. You would think so.
Well, isn't there a scripture in the Bible saying to the effect that whenever you have something, I won't say derogatory, but anyway, to say to a person, try to put it in a way that they can accept it. And maybe that's what he was doing. He was trying to put it in a way that they could accept it because it was a pretty harsh judgment.
Well, Ephesians 4 is where Paul talked about speaking the truth in love. Jesus, he spoke the truth. I believe all people would agree that he didn't speak it in hate. He spoke it in the most lovingly possible way. He spoke it as lovingly as he possibly could. But he appears to, maybe we can't understand or fathom all the reasons, but he apparently chose this language thinking that this would be the best way to reach these folks. But it is interesting to see the illustrations that he used. Sherman, and then we'll take your hand to
this. This isn't really unlike any parable that he taught. He taught in ways that they would understand. This would be like a visual for them, something that they've seen. They know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
That's what I
was looking at. Yeah. When you think about the houses, the widow's houses, they might have been able to think about some specific things when he's talking about the tombs in the next set of verses. The dishes that they washed, once again, maybe they had earlier that day or earlier that week, certainly probably earlier that month, washed those dishes. So it does take things up a couple of steps. But once again, it's a very, very graphic way to teach, but still to teach in a loving way.
I was just pretty much what he said, but I almost think it would have went over their head. Because they were so involved in being ritualistic with everything, even down to how they did dishes or how they cleaned, that this may have just been one more way of him saying, you know, you have your ritual, you've got it all backwards.
Well, people can become hard-headed. You can find, for example, in a marriage relationship, people can be together for 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, maybe 50 years, and one of the partners still doesn't get some of the things that trouble the other partner. Now, in this particular case, yeah, it just went over his head. No, I'm just kidding. But in this particular case, it seems like these fellas sort of operated on that same wavelength. So Jesus makes the point, comes back at it from another perspective, and he just layers it again and again and again and again, and they still do not get it. So people can sometimes be very, very thick-headed. Thinking about the thick-headedness brings us to 27 and 28. Matthew 23, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For ye are like unto whited sepulchres, which outwardly appear beautiful, but inwardly are full of dead men's bones, and of all uncleanness. Even so, ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but inwardly ye are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Now, bad enough to describe them as dishes which have been washed on the outside and not on the inside, plus all the other stuff. But if that's not enough, I mean, it's one thing to talk about dirty dishes. But when you start talking about graves, that really, once again, ups it a few notches. And this is the illustration. Jesus talked about sepulchers or tombs that have been whited. Now, there would have been in the first century some tombs, or there would have been some graves, just like today. You can go to a cemetery, maybe you can find a mausoleum, maybe you can find a headstone. And in the first century, there would have been some graves for some people who were very, very wealthy, and they would have been obviously marked. But there also seems to be some information that in the first century that, you know, if you're cutting through a field or something, or you're out in an area and there was a corpse that someone found, it seems like that was actually buried right there at that particular spot. I'm not sure about the reason for that, but there does seem to be some evidence to support that. Now, if you think about that practice, you found this body, you know, on the next lot over, it's buried right there. Remember, the Jews were very, very concerned about being contaminated in various ways. And if you came in to contact with a dead body, Numbers chapter 19, verse 16, that would have been a form of defilement. Okay, you're this Jew, you're coming into Jerusalem from out of town, and you come to this area, which unbeknownst to you, because you don't live there, there's this dead body. All right, to help people avoid that kind of problem, and I'm not sure that really would have been an issue if it was buried and so forth, because, you know, we walk over bodies all the time, you know, potentially. And the Jews certainly would have done the same kind of thing, because throughout history, people have died, and, you know, obviously graves not marked. But regardless, this was a big thing for them. So they would have this place where someone had died, and just like today, they'd set up a marker. But what would they do with the marker? They'd whitewash it. If you've ever seen a whitewash fence, I mean, it's there was actually like a plaster that was put on, and it was made to be very, very attractive. Well, that's not anything that's kind of disappeared with time. We may not whitewash graves today, but has anybody seen some of the more recent headstones? The ones that I'm thinking of have probably been made really popular within about the last 5 years. They actually are works of art. They will take a picture of maybe somebody on their motorcycle, and I don't know exactly how it's formed into the headstone. But, I mean, if you go through a grave, a cemetery now, and you see some of the gravestones, there are some elaborate, I mean, beautiful is maybe not the word that would first come to mind, but there are really some beautiful markers now. And the Jews kind of did this, and you would see that. It would be gleaming. It would look very, very nice. And that really seems to be the background here. So as people were coming to Jerusalem for the Passover, they would see these stones and say, oh, there is the marker, and there's a body there, so we want to avoid that. We will stay away from that. Well, all that would be true, but if you were to dig up the grave, what would you find as far as the corpse was concerned?
Bones.
All right, you'd find bones. And what about the stench? Yeah. Let's assume it's a relatively fresh death. You know, today, I had a funeral director tell me a few years ago, and after I thought about it, I thought it made perfect sense. But there was a situation, we were riding out to a funeral, and usually those fellows and I swap a couple of stories. And his story on this occasion involved someone who had been buried, the wife of a man, he was still living, and she'd been buried with a ring. He had begged the family, do not bury the wife, the mother, with the ring. But the family decided that they were going to do that. They insisted on that. Well, after some time went by, maybe a year or two, the kids continued to pester the dad for the ring, and the dad got tired of it. So he called up the funeral home and said to the director, we need to go ahead and remove the body. We need to exhume the corpse so I can pull the ring off of my wife's finger. So they did. And everybody was out there, cost a pretty penny, but they went ahead and exhumed the body, got the ring. The funeral director handed the ring over to the dad, and the dad just flung it to the kids and said, I never want to see you again. Don't ask me about the ring again. This is it. And then the body was put back into the ground. Now, as I listened to that particular story, I asked the funeral director, I said, what about the stench? What about the smell? It would seem to me if the body's been there for a while, you'd have some decay. He said, no, with the embalming practices that we have now, the body was basically looked as you would have seen it at the funeral home. He said that there was no decay, that was visible, and there was no stench. But when you think about the burials in this day and time, and again, you know, if it had been there for 500 or 1,000 years, we would expect that a lot of that would have dissipated and so forth. But in this particular case, you dig this up, and Jesus, it's going to be a very, very unpleasant thing. But outwardly, Jesus talks about how beautiful things look. Now, that's an interesting word. It's used just a few times in the New Testament. One of those times would be Romans chapter 10, verse 15. Remember, Paul, in talking about the feet of those who preach the gospel, he says, what are the feet? How beautiful. Same word that's used here. Well, just like the coffee cup, or the, not the coffee cup, but the cup and the platter illustration back there in 25 and 26, Jesus said, "You Pharisees, you scribes, you're like what? You're not only like the inside of the cup and the platter that hasn't been washed. Now," he said, "I want you to know that you are like this. You're like the corpse inside of a tomb." Now, if these guys were even halfway listening, you think that would have upset them? You think at this particular point they would have heard this and said, "Oh, wow. Jesus said, you appear," this is expressed with the present tense, "you appear to be righteous," verse 28, "but inwardly," he says, "you are full of hypocrisy. You're also full of iniquity." The word iniquity is an interesting word. There are multiple words for sin in the New Testament. This word that's translated iniquity, though, is probably the strongest, the worst word for sin. It literally has the idea of lawlessness. The word that's translated iniquity would mean that here is a person, he's presumably aware of the law, but what's he say about it? Doesn't apply to me. I don't have to follow it. Now, when you say to these people who claim to be great servants of God that they're lawless, they act as if God's law does not exist. Should that have upset them? It should have gotten their attention. It should have actually outraged them. They should have said, "Well, we're not lawless. We know God's law. We teach God's law. We follow God's law. We sit," as Jesus talked about earlier, "we sit in Moses' seat, and there's no way that this is true." We are certainly not like the rotting corpse in a grave, but Jesus said this is exactly it. So he comes down extremely hard on these people. Now, a little bit more, and then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with verses 29 to 32. Has anybody ever been at a scene where there is a body that's been decaying for a little while? At least a day, maybe a week? I've had that experience one time. Teresa has. But it was a situation that involved me while I lived in Elkhart County. There was a police scene. I was called out to go see someone and be with some folks. And to kind of give you the long and short of it, the deputy coroner had showed up with the police. The body had been there for a week. The scene was so bad that the spectators, if you will, and I would have been put in that particular category as well, we were at least 50 feet from the house. The door was closed. Everything was shut up in the house. And it was in the evening, there was a very slight wind. And they opened the door once, maybe twice. And when they opened the door, it was just like that odor rushed out. And even with just a small amount of wind, I mean, it just about knocked you over. I have never smelled anything like that in my life and never hope to again. I can only imagine, and obviously they've got on some pretty heavy-duty masks when they went into the house to either deal with the body or, look at the scene to see if, there was some kind of crime or, something else involved, something that didn't cause a fellow to die of natural causes. So when Jesus uses this illustration, if you've not smelled that particular smell, you just can't imagine how awful it is. But it is just about as bad as it gets. Trace?
Well, when Dad was on the fire department, they all carried Vicks with them. And they would just pass it and they don't even know get the Vicks before you get anywhere near the situation because it helped cover any smells.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've never smelled burning flesh. They say that's another smell that you never forget. It just sticks with you. Yeah. Decay sets in, virtually immediately, I believe. And like I say, after you have a body which has been exposed to the natural elements for a week, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Anybody else before we pick up with 29 to 32? Okay. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye build the sepulchres of the prophets and garnish the tombs of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we should not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore, ye witness to yourselves that ye are sons of them that slew the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers." Now this is where Jesus begins to bring his woes to a close. As we said, he's layered several charges together. He's leveled several charges against these people. And if they have not gotten it at this point, especially with that last illustration, you are like a rotting corpse. There's really not much else that you can say at this particular point. So it is at this juncture that Jesus sort of turns the attention a little bit to a new subject. He says, "I want you to think about this. There were people in the past, there were these ancestors of yours who persecuted God's people. God sent people like prophets. He sent his righteous servants into the world. The Jewish people, your ancestors should have treated these people well, but you failed in this regard. Verse 31 specifically says that the prophets had been killed by the ancestors of these people. Now today, we find some cases where a person will say, well, my dad or my grandpa or my mom or this ancestor lived in this particular way, and we do not approve of it. We have decided to go in a different direction. They were wrong, and this is the right way to live. But do we not also find some cases where people decide to follow in the steps of their ancestors? Yeah. My dad was like this. My grandpa was like this. This is a family tradition. And they're not speaking about something that is a positive tradition. Well, the Jews may not have learned, I think they probably did, but they may not have learned this from their ancestors, but they didn't like the teaching of people like Jesus, the apostles, so they were going to continue on in the tradition. Jesus, as you look at verse 34, he says these people were not only going to continue the tradition, were they going to be worse? Their ancestors had killed people like the prophets. Was the generation in Jesus' day going to be worse than the relatives? They were. How come? All right. Bad enough to kill, you know, Isaiah or Jeremiah. You can pick out any of the Old Testament prophets. Even if they'd killed them all, that would have been a horrible thing. But now God has sent his son into the world. And when you decide that God in the flesh is worthy of death, you really cannot do much worse than that. And Jesus knew this was precisely what these people were going to do. Now, a lot of times, when we see people today become involved with wrongdoing, do they try to hide it? Try to keep it a secret? Sure. What are some of the methods that people today use to keep their sin quiet? All right, they're not going to brag about it. Some others would say, we're going to do it, but we're not going to do it during the daytime. You know, we're going to go out at night when it's more difficult to see. What else do people do to hide their sin? All right, they're going to go, you know, to the neighboring county, or they're going to go to the neighboring town. Maybe they're going to go out of state. So people have come up with a lot of different ways to shield their activities from others. Did these men, though, decide to try to cover up their sins? They did. Look at verse 29. "Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for what do you do? You're builders. What do you build? The tombs, the sepulchers." So here are these fellas. They are the ancestors of people who killed the prophets. And as they're involved in this religious opposition, if you can imagine, you know, the sepulcher up on the hill for Prophet X. Oh, you can just imagine these fellas in the first century. It's so terrible that he was killed. What are we going to do to honor that man? We can't bring him back, but we can do what? We can garnish the tomb. We can build a monument to him. We would have been different. If only we'd been back there with our ancestors, maybe we would have stopped it. We certainly would not have participated in that kind of activity. Well, what did Jesus say about that? You're a liar. Your ancestors were involved in persecuting the prophets. And verse 30, if you had lived during their lifetime, you would have been what? You would have been partakers. You would have been participants. You would have had a hand in destroying these people. The Lord specifically describes that in the blood of the prophets. So at this point, the Lord knows that these people are lying. It's kind of interesting, and this ties into God's foreknowledge. These fellows did not live during the time of their ancestors. But Jesus said, had they lived during this particular time, did he know what they would have done? Isn't that interesting when we think about God's knowledge? Sometimes people today, you know, wonder what would have happened if we would have been born at a different time or born in a different culture, born in a different place, if we had married someone else, if we had fewer or more kids. God knows the answers to all of those hypothetical questions. Very interesting side point about God. All right, then as you come to the information in verse 32, what's Jesus say? I want you to fill up what? Fill up the measure of your fathers. What's he mean by that?
Guilt.
All right. That's going to be half the thought. You know, the guilt of your fathers, fill it up. So we know he's talking about the guilt. What's he mean by fill it up? Men can do this, but I think wives are probably a little more known for it. a husband has made a choice that maybe isn't the best choice, or not the choice his wife wants, so the wife says, okay, you go ahead and do it. You're already in hot water. But now, buddy, what? You've taken two steps. You might as well take the last two. You think any wives ever do that?
No.
Yeah, chicken. There are. We do that sometimes. You know, if you've gone this far, you might as well see it through. You might as well go ahead and take that next step. That's what the Lord's saying. If you are on this track, you make your decision. If you're going to do this, you go ahead and complete your activity. Now, what's that mean in the case of Jesus? Remember, he's just a few days before the cross. He says, fill up your guilt. We know what you would have done in the past as far as your ancestors. We know how your ancestors would have acted. We know how you've acted towards my teaching. I've called you every name in the book, and you've not corrected your life. Now what? Kill me. You call for my death. You support my death. If this is going to be the path that you're on, then you just go ahead and take it all the way. Did they do it? Sadly, they did. And sadly, many of them did not repent. One source described this as keep on sinning, and so prove yourselves to be just as evil as you are. This is precisely right. Anything that you want to ask before we pick up with the information in 33 to 36? And God certainly probably, he could have, you know, certainly found some other way to accomplish it. But in this particular case, the actions, the evil actions of these people did open up the door of salvation. So, God's not going to be, limited. But these fellas can be thanked, if you will, because of what their actions led to. Brian?
It reminds me of a reference you made in a class last couple of weeks about how that the Israelites, God made a land promise to Abraham, but the iniquity of the Amorites wasn't yet full.
Yeah.
So when their iniquity was full, God's promise was fulfilled. And that's real similar to what happened with Jesus here. Their iniquity was filled and that fulfilled God's promise.
Yeah, you do see that principle. Right, you do see that same principle. We didn't mention that particular class, but you think too about Sodom and Gomorrah. When were those areas destroyed? Abraham begins to try to bargain it down, starts out at 50, gets down to 10. Who's let out? Not 10. You basically got Lot and his family. You know, the wife doesn't make it, but Lot and his daughters. You know, the time had come where their wickedness had also reached that full capacity. So you're right, that would be a good point to go ahead and make here as well. Stan?
Verse 27 there is absolutely a double emphasis there when he talks about the whited sepulchres. Whitewash by its nature is an antiseptic. And so not only was the whitewash giving that, does it give a beautiful appearance, but it also would lead you to believe, if you saw that, that it would be squeaky clean. Mm-hmm. And so he's essentially saying, you're making yourselves beautiful, you're giving the indication that you're squeaky clean, but then in the verse it says, you're full of all uncleanness.
Yeah. And people today still oftentimes do that. And it's not just religious folks. Can you think of some other examples? The squeaky clean look?
Politicians.
They do. If you go back and you do some reading about politicians, they are a lot slimier. No, I kid you not. They are a lot slimier than people would believe. You know, they will hire, this is a well-known thing, they will actually hire people to train them in body language. That way, when they're giving a speech, you not only hear the words of the speech, sometimes body language doesn't always match up with verbal. I'm so happy today! Well, probably not. Okay? The guy that's got his face scrunched up and he's shaking both fists, it's kind of hard for me to believe he's happy. So politicians, and they've got, all kinds of people to go ahead and help them make sure that they get the right gestures at the right times with the right things. Now, when somebody's doing that, to either win a campaign or to give a speech to convince people to vote for him, that's fake. That's slimy. But when we think about these examples today, it's not anything that has by any means gone away. Okay, verses 33 through 36. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send you the prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall ye kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah the son of Bacariah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. It's often been said that Jesus talked about hell more than any other New Testament writer, and this statement is true. Jesus, being deity in the flesh, knew all about hell, and here, as he looks at the scribes and the Pharisees, does he say that these men deserve to go to this place?
Yes.
He does. This is pretty stiff. I mean, if it's not bad enough to say you're like the cup and the platter and you're the people who abuse the widows and you're the people who can't tell the truth when it comes to oaths and you are the people who are like, dead bodies in graves, then to come right out and tell the people, hell is reserved for people like you. Wow. I mean, how much more can you say to get through to folks? So he's still trying to be as kind as he can be, but these people are really, really dense. They are so evil that Jesus compares them to snakes. If you look at the text carefully, you will see that Jesus makes two different comparisons, and the comparisons are somewhat different. The first comparison is by what word? A serpent. Now, if you think of the word serpent in the sense of snake, that would seem to be a general word, and that would be correct. Here, the word that's translated serpent could describe a snake which is poisonous or not poisonous. This broad group of snakes. Now, what do you think Jesus meant by using snake in the general sense? You're like snakes. Poisonous snakes, non-poisonous snakes.
Poisonous.
Hmm? Well, okay, but here he includes the non-deadly snakes with the snakes that just, might nip at you and not hurt you as far as any kind of venom.
Well, one thing, they can sure sneak upon you.
All right, we think about the craftiness. We think about the subtleness. You're not looking there and bang, all of a sudden the snake comes out from the rose bush or the bunch of flowers or maybe some high weeds and so forth. Or out there in the rocks. People think, well, hey, let's go up here and play in the rocks, and there's not going to be anything up there that we can see, and lo and behold, you've got a snake there, and sometimes it's a poisonous snake. So shrewdness would seem to be the idea here with the first snake. Then Jesus uses a second word, but this second word, which is translated viper. And you can kind of see, I think, from the English, serpent, viper. Viper sounds like it's going to be deadly. It's going to be the poisonous snake. So, if shrewdness would be associated with the word serpent or snake, then what would we extract as far as a symbol or the figurative meaning from the word viper? You're also...
You're the worst.
Yeah, and you're deadly, spiritually. If people follow you, remember Matthew 15:14, if the blind guide the blind, what's going to happen? They're both going to fall in the pit. They're both going to go off the cliff. So Jesus... I guess these people could have thought, well, hey, we're subtle and crafty. But to make sure that they knew exactly what he was describing, Jesus said, you are like these poisonous snakes. You kill people with your false doctrine. Now, when we think about God, we know from, John 3:16, 2 Peter 3:9, God does not want any to perish. He sent his son into the world to save people. In the past, God sent people like prophets to help his people. Well, we know from what we've already studied that the Jews often killed God's people. But God says, I'm a God of love. So even though those righteous men that I sent in the past to help people have been killed, what am I going to do in the future? Under that New Testament that we now live under, Jesus said, what's going to be done? Are some more people going to be sent? Yes. The Lord specifically named several. He talked about prophets, wise men, and scribes. And when we look at the book of Acts, you can start with about Acts chapter 7, verse 58, for a real good example. Then look in Acts chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. At the end of Acts 7, who's killed? Stephen's killed. As Acts 8 opens up, we've got Saul pictured. He's that persecutor of the church. He wants to drag people off to prison. He wants to destroy people. Then as you continue to look through the book of Acts 17, verse 5, Acts 26, verse 11, we read how there were some hostile Jews. They wanted to persecute Christians. They went even from city to city to try to destroy God's people. Now, God is a very patient God. But are there times when God's patience finally wears thin? Yep, you can push God to the point where he says, you've had enough rope, and now it's time to go ahead and make some changes. Jesus said that this was also going to be true for the people of God, the Jews. As you look at verse 32, it's a promise there that God's patience was going to end. Jesus said, and let's look at that verse one more time. Fill ye up the measure of your fathers. Once again, you're coming to the end. And then, as you look at verse 35, he says, you fill this up so that upon you may come what? The righteous blood. And he mentions a couple of historical characters. Now, some might look at these verses and say, well, hey, the Jews were going to have to pay for the sins of their ancestors. Would that be true? Do we have to pay for the sins of others, spiritually speaking? No? No? We remember Ezekiel 18:20. Remember, the soul that sins, it shall die. The son doesn't bear the iniquity or the sin of the father. Sin is not transmitted. There's nothing such as Adamic sin. So that's not Jesus' point. But here, Jesus is describing not personal sin, but he's describing what we might refer to as national sin. It's a principle that we often see in the Old Testament. Once a nation becomes so corrupt, what's God done with it in the past? And presumably does the same thing now. All right, God says you're done. You've had your time. You have excelled in wickedness, and you have reached a point where you need to be overthrown. Well, this was precisely what happened with the nation of Jerusalem and the city of Jerusalem, the Jewish people. Jesus talks about this, Matthew 24, verses 1 through 34. In 70 AD, God used the Romans to attack the city of Jerusalem. The Jews lost their temple, and things did not go very well for them. Jesus experienced this. He said, all these things shall come upon this generation. As you look in verse 36, so this was not some kind of future promise in the sense that it was hundreds or it was thousands of years out. Now, as Jesus...
Basically, he told them, I've sent to you your prophets, the wise men, the scribes, and you killed them just like your fathers did. So that's why the blood, the righteous blood of Abel and Zechariah, that they're going to come on you just like the blood of the ones you've killed. All of it's going to come on you just because you've killed just like your fathers have.
I would agree with that. I would also add there, since there were going to be about 40 more years before this promise was actually fulfilled as far as the destruction, they were also going to shed some more blood. But enough had been, I mean, they were almost full. But by the time they took Jesus' life and they started to kill some people like Stephen.
And the apostles, you know.
Yes.
The lives that were taken. So, I mean, that was why it wasn't because their fathers had killed them
right.
that this was would come on them. It was because they had also killed them.
Yeah, there was just that long, long history. And in a lot of ways, people will reach a breaking point. There just comes a point in time where people will say, we can do no more, we can accept no more. Our nation has the three strikes and you're outlaw. You know, what happens with the fourth strike? Sorry, three was the limit. And once you reach that particular point, then there is this consequence. Anything else that you want to say, Micah?
Verse 27 talks about the whitewashed tombs and everything. I have a question reference to Luke 11:44.
Okay.
Exact contrast to that. You are like graves which are not seen, and men who walk over them are not aware of them. Where does that fall as far as time?
You've got there. Let's see. I would put that between, and this is a real rough guess, a year and 18 months. Prior to the time that we've got here in Matthew 18. So it was one of the things that Jesus, there were different times in his life when he appealed to the same teaching, and this was such a big deal that at least on two of the occasions in his teaching, and I think there's a pretty good chance that he probably used it more often than that, but just two of the times that he made this particular illustration. Anybody else?
I have just one comment on verse 33.
Okay.
Yes, little note here that you know what Jesus saying here pretty much echoed what John the Baptist told the Sadducees and Pharisees. He called them poisonous serpents or poisonous.